This is Financial Climate. Can innovations in finance help the world decarbonize? How can trillions of dollars of assets be redirected to catalyze a net zero economy? We explore these questions through conversations with innovators, experts, and investors from around the world. Here's your host, Alex Roth.
My guest today is Dmitry Gershenson, CEO of Enduring Planet. Enduring Planet is a relatively early stage startup whose focus is on lending money to businesses working on climate solutions. I wanted to know how the company has evolved so far and what his vision is for it. I wanted to understand what unusual challenges and opportunities the company faces in addressing the unmet financial needs of climate-related firms. Here's our conversation. Dmitry Gershenson, welcome to Financial Climate.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you are co-founder and the CEO of Enduring Planet. To start with, can you just tell us what is Enduring Planet and what does it do?
Yeah, we are a fintech lender focused exclusively on the new climate economy. So we provide fast, flexible, and founder-friendly capital options for climate entrepreneurs, big and small. Today, we have two instruments through which we invest in climate. We have a what we call the Climate Grant Advance, effectively where we provide working capital to typically R&D and early commercialization climate businesses that have large state or federal grants, where often those are on a reimbursement basis. And so there are liquidity challenges around investing in the project and then getting paid. And we provide effectively a factoring product to support those entrepreneurs. And then we also have a revenue-based financing instrument where we provide growth financing to, we call it sort of early revenue climate businesses, generally folks who have either recurring or otherwise predictable revenue, strong gross margins, and a history of consistent growth. We've made just over 20 investments in the year that we've been active, just over $6 million in capital deployed, and pretty excited for the year to come.
You said your company has only been active for about a year. What is your background prior to that, and what led you to decide to found the company?
I've spent my entire career working either in climate or adjacent to climate. I spent sort of the first half of it working in emerging markets on issues around energy access and sustainable development. And that's where I sort of started to get a better understanding of the levers that are available to folks like me to make an impact on climate change. And one of the ones that was sort of most appealing was the opportunity to increase the flows of capital into climate change. There's lots of different estimates, but there are these numbers sort of 5 to 10 trillion in a year of investment is required to get us to stay below 2°C in terms of the elevation of global temperatures. And by most accounts, I think the last analysis that was done by the Climate Policy Institute was we were spending somewhere around $700 billion to $1 trillion a year on this problem, which means we're either 1/5 or 1/10 of the way there per year. That's a very large gap. And it is really important for us to act with urgency to address the capital gap in climate, because money is what's going to make all of these solutions get developed, scale, grow, et cetera, despite what some of us might want around how our economic system works. We exist in capitalism, and we're not going to dismantle capitalism in the next 2 decades. And that means that we have to use the tools that are available to us to affect change in this market. If you look at the proliferation of residential solar, a lot of that is due to the fact that residential solar financing became an available tool for consumers. And so, similarly, there's a lot of need for innovative credit products in climate, and there's very little innovation. And so it seemed like the right time, right opportunity to build a business like this.
That's interesting. And so how is it that you came about this type of model? Banks do lending, but you're operating outside the normal banking space, and you're operating outside the normal kinds of venture capital or other types of funding. So how did you come up with this type of model, and why that model?
I formed the company in May of 2021. My co-founder joined me in July. That's really when we started working on it. And then we launched publicly last April. So that's where that year Comet came from. We've been sort of working on the problem for almost 2 years. For me, when we started, the question was, okay, if I want to build a company and not a fund to advance capital availability in climate, what would that need to look like? And there were a few like key elements. One is that I think it's important that technology needs to play a role to accelerate underwriting, origination, and servicing. And there's been a lot of innovation around computer vision, predictive models, active learning models. Like, there's all these tools that have now emerged in the last decade more that enable folks to automate parts or all of an underwriting process. That was one key consideration. Another was, how do we build it in such a way that we can access and blend diverse forms of capital that can enable us to have a lower cost across our portfolio and therefore offer a lower cost of capital to our borrowers? And in order to do that, there's only so many models that you can pick where you can then effectively raise from foundations, from DAFs, donor advised funds, from institutional investors, blend that money. Depending on the type of institution you build, you can or can't do that. So that was another consideration for the model. And then third is, we wanted to have a lot of flexibility around the products that we offer, because I think the space is evolving so rapidly that there are multi-billion dollar lending opportunities popping up every day. And so the question was, okay, well, how do we combine the sort of nimble flexibility of being able to offer different products, automation, and the ability to take in blended capital, and how do we create a vehicle around that? And that was the motivation for Enduring Planet. I think for us, we also care deeply about the experience that entrepreneurs have when accessing the capital in the first place. And we wanted to have the agency and the flexibility to be able to structure products the way that we think works for our customers while managing that risk return dynamic. And, you know, if you put all those things together, the structure we picked and the model that we picked kind of makes a lot of sense.
I see. And so you talk about these automated tools. So can you explain a little more about like what those automated tools do or how they operate? Do they provide a traditional type of lending analysis with greater efficiency, or do they do something different?
Yeah. So I would say that today we are a tech-enabled lender rather than a fully automated lender. A lot of our process is still manual. We are figuring out where we spend time and effort, and then we sort of focus our technology development work on those pieces of the origination, underwriting, and servicing process, right? Like, those are the three major steps in a loan's life cycle. You have to find a customer and get them in and pull all their data. You have to then review and analyze all the data, and then you make a loan decision, and then you have to manage the loan. And throughout that life cycle, there's a lot of opportunity for automation and time reduction. And so the things that we have built. So today we have a very simple application process where folks come onto the website, they apply, takes about 10 minutes. As part of that process, they connect their banking and accounting systems to our backend through an API. And that allows us to source raw data as opposed to self-reported data. It requires way less validation. It's a really strong deterrent for fraud. It's pretty hard to fake a bank account and an accounting system, although we have seen it done. That whole process takes 10 minutes. They apply, we get their information. Barring any surprises or any like weird complexity, we can then typically issue a term sheet in about a week. And that's for both our RBF and our grant advance product. If they're applying for the grant advance, they also submit some documentation around the grant. It's not just financial connections. We want to see a proposal. We want to see a timeline of payments. But still, you can typically do that if you have everything handy, 10 to 15 minutes. If we're looking at an RBF transaction, and also for the grant advance, all that raw data gets fed into our proprietary backend, and then it gets categorized and matched so that we can get a really comprehensive cash basis revenue picture of the business. And that enables us to really understand how cash flows go through any kind of company. That data gets fed into a prediction engine, which then predicts future revenue based on historical performance. That is also done automatically. We can tweak that model manually based on additional documents submitted. And then once we pick one of those like multiple scenarios based on the data that we have, it automatically generates a revenue-based financing offer. Arguably, in a perfect case, when someone comes to us and they clear all the initial hurdles. There's nothing weird about their business. We have a term sheet ready for them in 20 minutes. In reality today, we're still figuring out how much we trust our prediction model, how much we trust our categorization. So there's still like manual review, but over time that process is going to speed up a lot. We've only been writing code for about a year. And so forward looking, there's a lot that we can automate around document review, which is something that we also spend a lot of time on, especially for the grant advance. And then there's a lot of automation we could do on the servicing that we do monthly. So like reviewing previous month's transactions, generating an invoice, drawing payments, that's also a pretty manual process typically. And so I think for us, like right now, we're probably at a point where we've cut like half of the diligence time for an RBF deal. I want to cut that down probably 90%. And then for the grant advance, we want to do kind of similar. And for every product that we launch, right, every additional instrument, we have sort of similar aspirations. And it's actually something that goes into our decision process for how we pick instruments. Like, can this be largely automated? What are the considerations around automation? Is it a question of simpler diligence, tighter structuring? There's all these options for crafting the entire model in a way that allows it to be more automatable.
I see. But then in addition to that, though, the basic terms you offer are different. So can you talk about how your offerings differ and how are you able to do that? For example, some cases, collateral can be an impediment to lending to a perfectly creditworthy type of organization. But at the same time, of course, there's reasons why banks have these kinds of requirements.
Maybe the way that I would respond to that is the complexity of a loan and the covenants and collateral and guarantee requirements drive price. One thing that happens is that our capital is more expensive because it has lower security. There's no personal, we don't do personal guarantees. We think they're incredibly exclusionary. We have very low or light security for our products. Like RBF is basically unsecured.
The revenue-based finance you're talking about, yeah.
That's right. The grant advance is secured against receivables from the grant only. We don't file liens on IP or take physical collateral. A lot of those things are really prohibitive for access to capital, but traditional lenders, they've always done that. They'll never not do that. There are plenty of alternative credit providers who operate in similar models like us. For example, Brex, they lend to you a portion of your cash. They basically front you more against your cash balance. They don't take collateral. Stripe Capital, Square Cash, like there's all these alternative credit providers who have kind of similar models. It's generally a question of trading off cost and structure against security. So that's one. I think two is that we've worked in the space for a really long time. And so we understand the dynamics of some of these receivables better than others. And so that allows us to then price more appropriately while retaining lower security requirements and still feel comfortable with the risk profile. And some of that is done in the way that it is structured, like in terms of when interest is paid, how it accrues, what maturity terms or balloon payments there might be, what true-up payments there might be.
And for things like interest rate paid and the repayment period of debt, I know these vary by individual loan, but can you give a general idea of how the cost or terms of your offerings would typically come out relative to those of conventional banks, which, as you were saying, would often require a personal guarantee or collateral?
It's not a simple question to answer, to be totally honest. So with revenue-based financing, it's a contingent credit instrument where the cost of capital is directly dependent on performance against the model that we develop for their revenue. So we underwrite to a certain IRR, but if the company underperforms the model, their cost of capital is actually dramatically lower. If they overperform the model, the cost of capital might be higher, but it's a time bound. So for us, like the absolute amount of interest that you will pay on your RBF loan is actually fairly fixed. It's just a question of how quickly you pay it based on your revenue performance. And so we have a range of like revenue share percentages. Let's say we do $500,000 loan. We typically won't go above a 10% rev share. We're typically in the like 3 to 10. Sometimes companies have a lot of revenue and they want a small loan. And so then, you know, it might dip below 3, but we'll typically never go above a 10% rev share because we feel like it can be kind of too extractive on the liquidity of the business. With the grant advance, we publicly advertise the range of interest rates. It often depends on the timing of payments on the grant. And so depending on how principal is being paid down, that affects the actual cost of capital for the loan. The thing too is that banks don't offer these products. There isn't like an apple to apple comparison, right? Like a bank is not going to let you pay based on how you're doing. They want you to make an interest and principal payment every month. And so if you have a bad month in terms of cash flow, you're still on the hook to pay. If you don't pay, you start tripping default covenants. In our case, with revenue-based financing and the grant advance, you pay when you get paid. And that flexibility is built into the product.
And so that's what you're talking about when you say rev share. You're talking about a share of revenue, that the payments they make on a periodic basis are based on how much they're earning in revenue for a particular period of time.
That's right. Yeah. So with revenue-based financing, at the start of every month, we look at the past month's gross cash receipts and we debit our percentage of those gross cash receipts from the borrower. And so if they had $0 in gross cash receipts, then we debit zero. If they had, you know, if we're doing a 5% rev share and they had $100,000, then we debit $5,000.
But the total amount that's paid over the time period is set in advance. So you're saying, let's say your interest rate's going to be 10% over, let's say it was a 1-year loan, your interest is going to be 10% over the course of that year, but you'll take it based on a percent of revenue per month until you hit the amount that you need?
More or less. It's not exactly like that. Like we set a rev share percentage that runs monthly, but then the loan truncates once principal is repaid via the portion of the rev share that's paying principal. And so it effectively locks the absolute cost of capital over time. There's like a little bit of wiggle room because there's sort of time value of money considerations, but effectively it's capped. You can't overpay.
And do you set the maturity of the loan, or is the maturity just like you keep taking the revenue share until it's paid off?
With revenue-based financing, we set an estimated term for when we expect it to pay off, but there isn't a fixed maturity date. We do have a true-up clause around principal true-ups, so that, I guess, it effectively establishes like a maturity date past the expected payment term. It's usually 6-12 months longer where we're doing true-ups. On the grant advance, there is an explicit maturity date. It's usually 6-12 months.
Okay. I'm curious if you have one or two examples of businesses that you funded that have been able to use this kind of revenue financing to facilitate their success.
Recently, we completed a grant advance with a company called New Sun Road, where they are doing some really innovative work in Latin America, providing renewable decentralized microgrid systems for educational centers. We provided them the working capital they needed to execute on that grant. We've worked with them twice now. So we had a rep share deal with them before, and now we have a grant advance. We did a grant advance transaction with a company called Dollaride out of New York. They are building a $10 million grant with NYSERDA. They're building a really incredible electric vehicle, quasi-mass transit network. And so we provided them some additional working capital to execute on that project.
Can you talk about the criteria that you use to assess clients? Or maybe another way to say that is, suppose a company walked in the door that was very much not green. What sort of activity or attribute of that company would make you say, that's not what we do around here, go somewhere else, from a perspective of their mission or their association with the climate?
Yeah, I mean, we don't discriminate based on quantum of impact. So we are just as happy providing capital to folks who have, I don't know, a software product with very indirect links to decarbonization. I think your question is like, well, when do we say no? We say no all the time. Companies come to us all the time that aren't in climate. There are cases where folks are doing something that might be sustainable, but it doesn't actually advance decarbonization, removal, or adaptation and resilience. And in those contexts, it's a question of just looking at the mission and the primary goals of that business and thinking about it in the context of sort of like the new climate economy. The company has to be thinking about it in that way. They have to be framing it in that way. Their documentation needs to support that case. And so our decision around whether or not a company fits the climate bucket is something that's still very subjective. I think over time, we're going to try to automate at least the majority of those decisions and then like leave the edge cases to human determinant. One example that I like to use sometimes is we had a company approach us that is working towards building this like decentralized kind of Web3 data storage platform that is supposed to be net zero, like carbon neutral. And we're like, cool, do you advertise it as a carbon neutral Web3 decentralized data storage platform? They're like, no. Are you carbon neutral today? No, we're working towards it. We're working towards net zero. And I was like, okay, well, when you are at zero emissions and your platform and your advertising and your marketing says, hey, we are selling to you as a net zero, zero carbon data storage platform, then yes, you would be in scope. But for now, like the aspirational elements don't count.
To the extent that you feel comfortable talking about it, I'd love to hear more about how Enduring Planet itself is funded. Obviously, any kind of a financially oriented company that's lending money out has to in some way align their expected revenues with the requirements of the capital that they're deploying.
Enduring Planet is funded through a variety of capital sources. We largely fund the operating company through venture capital. So we're a venture-backed startup. And then we raise debt to then redeploy as debt. We raised our first facility last year. This is about $5 million from a mix of impact-focused investors, family offices, private foundations. Cisco Foundation was a big investor of ours, a corporate foundation, and a few donor-advised funds invested in that first facility. And we're now working on our second one. It's going to be quite a bit larger. We're hoping to announce something around that this half publicly. For us, the goal is to continue to source incrementally lower cost capital so that we can continue to bring down our cost of capital to borrowers. The delta between what our borrowers see as their cost and what we pay to our lenders has to include the expected loss rate, operating costs, et cetera, some degree of profit margin. But I think that if you look across the ecosystem, our cost of capital is either on par or quite a bit cheaper than our peers who offer comparable products. And part of that is because we're able to source impact-aligned, lower cost capital already, even this early in the game.
I see. And so just to make sure I get that right, what you're saying is the money that you lend out the door as loans comes in the door to you as loans?
That's right. Yeah. But typically on slightly different terms that allow us to manage liquidity effectively.
I see. One of the things I was going to ask you about is just from looking from a financial perspective, from a far distance, it's interesting to be a venture-backed firm that does lending to other venture-backed firms, because you'd think that that would amplify the swings in the business cycle. In other words, when times are really good, they're really good. And then when they're bad, they're more bad than might be the case for other companies. But it sounds like that in some ways, this approach of borrowing the money that you're lending out tends to mitigate that, because then the dollars that you're seeking to lend out are not those venture capital dollars. They're dollars that have a expectation that's more aligned with what a lender would see. But I'm interested to hear how you think about that problem or that issue.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, one thing that is probably important to note is that we don't exclusively lend to venture-backed companies, and we never will. That carries a lot of correlated risk. We're seeing that with lenders who focus exclusively on SaaS or other venture-backed industries. Venture debt is a good case of large correlated risk. I would say about half of our portfolio, I would classify as either SMB or not traditional venture-backed. And we expect that to continue to expand. There's much more opportunity to lend to SMBs, small, medium-sized businesses in the US than there is to startups. There's just more of them. They're also generally, you know, break-even or cash flow positive. Like, there's a lot of reasons why it makes for a better opportunity. Yes, it is true that the climate startup ecosystem is seeing some of the same reductions in funding that other venture ecosystems are seeing. But even then, it's not nearly as dramatic.
Do you think that there's big differences between climate-related lending versus other kinds of lending? And if so, what kinds?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that within the climate ecosystem, there are unique liquidity challenges that we might not see elsewhere. One good example is in the sort of contractor universe in climate, so solar, energy efficiency, there are often liquidity challenges tied to state, federal incentive payments, so tax rebates, incentives, pay for performance. Like, there's all these models where basically the business that is trying to get the payment has to do the work up front and then get paid later. That's, I think, pretty unique to this ecosystem. There's about to be this massive pool of tax credits that's going to start appearing in this market as soon as the IRA starts to pay out up to $80 billion a year. Historically, like, tax equity has played a big role in the development of the renewable space, while the IRA kind of flips tax equity on its head with the transferability and direct pay elements of those tax credits. And so that creates this massive opportunity for folks to support those liquidity challenges, because often these developers have to like do the work and then wait for the IRS to pay them. And there's like infinite cases like this where there are unique receivables that are climate related that folks effectively want to like collateralize or turn into assets that they can then borrow against, they can raise money against, they can have forward contracts against. You know, you have these advanced purchase commitments tied to carbon removal credits. Carbon offsets are a unique instrument, and people want to figure out ways to advance some of those payments because they're often on long-term horizons. And so I think the grant advance is also kind of unique to climate. Like, yeah, there are grants in other spaces, but the volume and the structure of a lot of these grant agreements for climate specifically presents a unique opportunity because of the urgency of the problem and the scale of the problem, which means that like as a lender, you can build some comfort around building a business around lending in that space. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, not exactly what I would have expected, but really interesting. I want to talk about another thing, which is these early stage companies so often it traditionally have been funded through venture capital. And for people who are not part of the tech ecosystem, I think they may not recognize the nature of venture capital, but in essence, it's been humongously effective for developing some tremendous, tremendous innovation and making the United States and Silicon Valley an engine of innovation going back for decades. But then at the same time, the basic premise of venture capital is that venture capitalists make a very large number of bets on very early stage companies with the expectation that a very small minority of those are going to be spectacularly successful, like the next Google or the next Uber or whatever it is. And those are going to make up for all these other companies that have okay returns or just flame out. So what that means is that while it's a great model for those companies that have those aspirations and those expectations, it's actually a terrible model for many, many, many companies. From your perspective then, doing lending to these kinds of climate-related companies, to what degree do you see the revenue-based financing that you offer as an alternative to venture capital funding as opposed to a supplement to companies that are already venture-backed?
We have done revenue-based financing with companies that are not venture-backed, and we have done revenue-based financing with companies that are. I don't know if like revenue-based financing is always the right product. There are lots of businesses who don't have the predictability of revenue to support an RBF deal. And in those contexts, they need other specialty credit products. And that's something that we're going to keep developing over time. The cool thing about money is that you can structure it however the hell you want. There's no one out there who's saying, hey, like, if you do a loan, it must look like this. That's actually one of the things that we think holds the climate finance industry back, is that so many people are married to these like antiquated ideas of what products can and should exist in the market.
Yeah. And so related to that, can you talk a little bit more about where you see those big gaps that are not yet filled in terms of financing these companies?
There's not like one or two big gaps. The entire ecosystem is underserved. The entire ecosystem, solar, HVAC, building performance contractors, carbon removal businesses where they might have credits in the future that need to get pre-funded today. I mean, there's like growth financing needs, early stage, mid stage, later stage. That's kind of how we approach the space, is like, let's understand who needs capital for what, and let's figure out if we can effectively evaluate risk and then create a product that commensurately has pricing and structure that addresses that risk, and then let's put it out into the market.
Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. Dmitry Gershenson, thank you so much for joining us on Financial Climate.
Thank you so much. This was really cool. I really appreciate the depth of questions. I think it's so common that folks kind of look at these issues at a surface and kind of move on because it's just, it's money, it's whatever. It's not the cool widget, but I think it's actually as important, if not more important at times, to understand how capital plays a role in driving this transition.
Right on. Thanks. Yeah, I think of it as a critical infrastructure, even though it's not physical the way other types of infrastructure is. Yep. And when there's a financial crisis, then you see it. Its collapse is every bit as impactful as the sewer system breaking.
That's right. Well, thanks so much.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Financial Climate. If you enjoyed the show, you can help us grow by rating us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Our website is financialclimate.fm, and you can email us at feedback@financialclimate.fm.